Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two Narrys podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Sean is on the production. How are you, Sean?
Not too bad, how are you?
Our friend Georgie's in the audience. How are you, Georgie? This is about your fourth time being here. Yeah. Past guest as well. And your friend is in the hot seat today, Edwina Grosvenor. Is that how you say your second name?
Yeah, you can say it like that. Yeah. Grosvenor, Grosvenor. Yeah. It actually means the fat hunter in French.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that, did you? Anyway, let's quickly moving on.
I know. But you're a criminologist and you're a philanthropist and you do a lot of work around prisons and prison reform and advocacy for prisoners. So we're delighted to have you on because that's kind of what we do too, minus the philanthropy. But we're working on it. When we get the means, we'll be able to do it. But before you get into that, do you want to just tell us like how you got into that or why you got into that?
Yeah, so... I've been working in prisons for 23 years now, so since I was 18, but I can definitely track it back to when I was about 12 years old and my older sister was about 14, and my parents were obviously having discussions in the background. I know this now because I've got a 12-year-old daughter and two other kids, and I think they were worried about how they were going to educate us about drugs and, you know, life. We were going to inherit wealth. So I think that was playing on their mind and how they were going to probably stop us snorting our inheritances up our noses, quite frankly.
You're descended from the Romanovs, amongst other kind of...
Yeah, you've done your research.
But it's interesting because we've never had somebody with that kind of a heritage on the studio, and most of the people listening mightn't ever have come across somebody with that type of heritage. But what's it like knowing? Like, are you very aware of that when you're a child? Are you very aware of, I suppose, your background and the privilege? Or how are your parents trying to keep you level-headed?
Yeah, I mean, I'll come on to that, but sort of just on the first question. So when I was 12 and they were worried about the sort of drugs, they basically decided that they weren't the right people to educate us about drugs because they knew we wouldn't listen to them, which was correct. So they took us to a drug rehabilitation centre in Liverpool on a place called Hope Street. And my sister and I went into this room and we sat down with two heroin users, a man and a woman. They were in a relationship together and they just were like, ask us anything you want. And honestly, it had the most profound effect on me that hour, because if you're a football fan, it was like meeting your football star. Mm. And I know that sounds really weird, but I was like, nobody ever would allow a child to sit with a heroin user and just, this is like, I don't know why, but I knew age 12 that it was an incredible experience. A privilege might sound too condescending, but it was just like mind blowing for me in a good way.
Was that your first time ever coming into contact with somebody who'd used drugs or was addicted to
knowingly that I knew of? Yeah. And the fact that it was just like, ask whatever you want, don't worry. And I did. And so that was where I track it back to. Then, growing up through my teenage years, in answer to your second question about was I aware? Yeah. I was brought up in a house called Eaton Hall in Chester. Sort of probably, it looks like a palace and it's behind black and gold gates and the drive is like a couple of miles long. Too long. It doesn't need to be that long, but it is. And I went to a very sort of normal school, really. There were kids who, you know, their parents were dentists and doctors, or sort of, you know, I wasn't in a school where there were lots of other people like me who had titles. Yeah. So we got a little bit of bullying for having titles. Even the teachers would say some weird things sometimes. Yeah. But quite frankly, everyone was being bullied for something. You're either too fat, too thin, too ginger, too blonde, too something. And so our thing was like, oh, well, you're a lady and your dad's a duke. So people give us crap about that, but so it didn't bother me too much. But I was very aware when I was 15, I started doing work experience. And one of the things I did for work experience was to work at a charity called Save the Family. And it's where mums went as a last ditch attempt to be able to learn how to look after their children properly so that their children weren't removed from them and taken into care. And I was only there for a week. And again, that had a colossal impact on me. The day I got there, there'd been a suicide of a mother, and, you know, and the children were sort of there, and I was just, and they, my mother was the patron of that charity, and so they knew who I was, and so they were constantly saying, do you have blue blood? How much pocket money do you get? And, you know, firing questions, which was quite intense, and a lot of these kids, their dads were in prison, or they were drug dealers, you know, all the stories, and I remember thinking, going home to my massive house in the evening, and then being like, this is really weird. I've just like been born into this family, and that's really, really lucky. Mm. And they've been born into that family. And like, what chance do they have? And maybe if they lived in my house, they'd be happier. Or so it was really early on when all those big moral questions of
sounds like happening. You had great awareness at a young age, like for somebody
mature.
When I was 15, the only thing that was on my mind was drugs and drink and criminality and women. You know, but at that age, like you're inside in this setting and it's work experience and you're seeing what's going on and you have this compassion and empathy and go home then and say to yourself, like, you know, how fortunate am I? Not many 15-year-old children have that kind of awareness.
And I suppose I've got my parents to thank for that, right? You know, they took me out of my lovely little home and just went, boop, there you go, sink or swim.
Yeah,
and even though it was only 5 days, it felt like it was months or years because it's still so. I remember being so nervous and walking up to that front door to the house, and you know, there were often rows. It was really sort of, you know, there were lots of women there, and it was could be quite chaotic just for the nature of the people that were there. But that then set me on a path because, you know, I remember going for a day trip with the kids to the zoo, and they saw some people, and obviously the people triggered them somehow, or some of the men looked like one of their dads, and they were talking about prisons and they were talking about death and gangs. And I remember being like, even though it was kind of, I was like, oh, it's really out of my comfort zone, but I was like, it's kind of interesting as well. I wonder what prison's like, and I'd love to know more about gangs. And so there was definitely a yes, I'm a bit scared, but I quite enjoy being a bit scared. That's been a bit of a theme of my life as well, like enjoying kind of being out of my comfort zone.
And when you finished school, did you go straight into university, and what did you study?
So I never really wanted to go to uni, but I'm glad that my mum kind of convinced me that I should. So I finished A-levels, did a gap year, travelled. The first time I went into a prison was in Central Jail in Kathmandu when I was 18.
What was it like?
So it was the women's side of the prison. And when I went in... And by the way, all my other friends had gone up the Gold Coast of Australia in a camper van, were getting drunk. And I'm like, why am I in a prison in Nepal? But I was like the happiest 18-year-old ever, and definitely had a more interesting time. And the women's side of the prison, you know, they had been washing. And so the washing was up on the line. They were all brushing each other's hair in the sun. And it was quite domestic. And there were a few kids running around in there as well. And then I came out and went round to the male side. Didn't go into the male side, but that was a completely different story. There was a big white man, actually a big Westerner, standing at the gates, and they were like, we're not going to go into the male side. And I was like, yeah, perfectly happy with that. And I said, what's he in for? And I kind of knew what he might be in for. And it was offending against children. And there were little boys locked up in there with him.
Oh my God.
And I remember just being like a little part of me kind of breaking. But that was the first time I'd been in a prison or experienced prisoners. And and again, that was another moment that was just like, so now I can look back and see all these moments that really kind of either changed the course of my life or just kept, you know, I've always been on the prison trajectory.
When something like that happens in life, like that situation, looking at him in the prison and knowing that these young boys are there, that's something that you don't ever forget.
No.
You know, it sits with you. It's like an experience that you have in life that you'll never forget it, because it just gave you so much emotion. It may be fear or something through a dog or an experience. And that's just one of, it's quite similar to something like that. It stays with you in your mind.
Yeah, exactly. And also looking at things like that, because I always think, right, how do I've seen something bad, how do I fix it? And then you kind of go, would it really be difficult to not have little boys in that side of the prison? Couldn't they be in the other side of the prison? Or isn't there somewhere else they can go that would be better? And you think, well, that doesn't seem like a particularly difficult thing to fix. So I was always horrified, but at the same time, I weirdly always left thinking, oh my God, but this is so easy to change. And it's obviously not easy to change, is it? But I always had that optimism.
Yeah, but it's like with myself and Timmy, because we're lucky now that we've come through kind of difficult lives with addiction and prison and stuff like that. But when you get this situation then where we're working and we're educated, we're in a good place, but you know all these people that are left behind, and you know like some of the best people you'll ever met have been in prison, some of the best, you know, the toughest experiences, many of them victims themselves, and a lot of potential. So that's kind of like why me and Timmy wanted to do this, is just to kind of not leave them behind. I feel like if we can reach out to them, because this podcast is shown in prisons in Ireland as well. So it's like through the podcast and through the media, we might spark something in them, you know, that they can go to the education or the psychologist or the counsellor and start their journey, because that's all we did.
He just recently, I received a letter from a prisoner. I only received it recently, and it came through somebody else. And he just telling me how much he enjoys the podcast, how much it helps him, because they're in the prisons and they can watch him on the prison video channel. And he said he's after getting motivation from it. He hasn't been sentenced or anything like that. And then he turned around and he says, maybe when I get out, you'll give me an opportunity to work, you know? And like, what brings it back then for me is this, right? I'll give that young lad an opportunity, because if I didn't get the opportunities off other people that were there for me, I wouldn't be sitting here at the moment. And it's very important that we don't just walk or talk the talk, we also walk the walk, you know, and we could do a lot more walking the walk. But two of us have full-time jobs, we have families and things like that. But like, when I read something like that and seeing the change that we're actually creating for the people who really do matter the most to us are those, because
it's a great responsibility as well, isn't it? And massive. You know, sometimes a bit like, oh, can I help all these people? If everyone asks for a job, you're not going to be able to say yes, are you?
That's the other side of this, you know.
But it's very rewarding then, though, like when you're in prison and you're speaking to these vulnerable women, or when you do media appearances and somebody sees it, or when we do stuff like this, the people listening in the prison might be the first time they've ever felt understood, or they could feel like, you know what, that person has my back, or that person sees an innate.
Yeah, or why do they care?
Yeah.
Like women always say, why does someone in your position care about someone like me? And I was like, what do you mean in my position? They're like, well, you're a lady. And I'm like, yeah, but that doesn't mean it. Like, if we really are honest with each other, it doesn't mean anything. And, you know, and it's really interesting because people will sometimes behave towards me in a way because they're a bit nervous and don't understand how they should be with me. And I completely get that. So I spend most of my life trying to make people feel more comfortable around me. And, you know, my bank cards, for example, I had my title lady taken off because, you know, I'd be in a supermarket and, you know, occasionally I'd be like, I'd get questioned on it. And so I'd sort of say to people, you know, it's, and when I say to prisoners, there is literally nothing different. Okay, yes, there's differences between you and I. I've got this and I've got that and you're in here. But really, at the end of the day, I don't mean to sound cheesy, but we are human.
Yeah.
And it's only class and society and all these invisible made up things that kind of make us different.
Yeah.
But I'm the same if you want me to be the same.
Exactly.
But I'm different if you treat me differently.
Exactly. And over the last few years, we've had just normal Joe Soaps in here, regular people with interesting stories. We've had the leader of our country in here, the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin. The Minister for Finance was in here a few weeks ago. but all just regular people with their own stories, they're overcoming their own obstacles in their own lives. And when you take away the titles and the status and all that, what you're left with is just people trying to get by, trying to be the best person they can be, look after their families and kind of be good citizens. And that's it at the end of the day, isn't it?
Exactly. And life's more relaxing when you see life like that.
I know.
You know, everyone gets stressed.
Yeah.
Everyone's got family problems. Everyone's either on a diet or trying to give up the booze or, you know, everyone's just doing human things.
Yeah. But you studied criminology.
I did, yeah. Yeah, so I went to university after my gap year, studied criminology and wrote my dissertation on children being born into mother and baby units and the separation effect of the baby when they're being taken away from the mothers. Mm. And so a lot about the attachment theory and then obviously adverse childhood experiences, we now call them, don't we? And early childhood trauma that people talk a lot more about. But, you know, I did that degree 20 years ago. And then recently I just did a master's in, it was a criminological one, but in crime scene management and forensic evidence. Mm. And then wrote my thesis for that on female victims of rape and how they're portrayed by the tabloid media. So that was made for grim reading.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess I'm a bit of an obsessed criminology fan.
Are you following the Andrew Tate stuff at the moment?
Well, yeah, I've got three kids in school. And so, you know, we've had the letter from school to say, by the way, we are going to be tackling this at age appropriate time with the children.
I think it's very damaging for feminism and kind of women's rights as well around, like, because he's got such a big following and people are very quick to jump on and say he's been set up and there's conspiracy against him and the women like that. Like, it's so hard for to get a conviction of something like rape and stuff like that, you know, but I don't want to get you dragged into a culture war now, like, but it is very damaging, and isn't it, having somebody like him with such a platform?
Yeah, and what's terrifying is that he's got so many followers. But, you know, what I learned about doing the research into rape for my thesis was, first of all, 98.5% of people get away with the rape that they commit. So it's virtually legalized by default in England. And then, of course, we've had this big case of another Met police officer in the same unit as Wayne Cousins, who killed Sarah Everard. This guy is called David Carrick, and he's pleaded guilty to 49 counts of rape and keeping women under the stairs and in basements and controlling them.
Is this
the Met police officer? Yeah, just happened this week.
Yeah, he had a cellar in his home.
And then people don't bother, it's really depressing. And of course, you know, what women have been saying for a long time is we don't really feel very safe reporting it if it does happen, because people don't take it seriously. You're not going to get a prosecution, so actually why bother? It won't go to court for a year or two. You know, are you going to live in that sort of, and then equally you might end up with a police officer, you know, like Carrick. And of course these are the bad apples.
Yeah.
And there's many, many brilliant police officers. I spend loads of time with the police and they're some of the best people I've ever met.
Yeah.
But of course, there are entrenched institutional problems that particularly women have been talking about for a very long time. And all you get is apologies and we'll do better. And it sort of just gets really boring.
There was a case in Cork a few years ago. I thought I was seeing things, but it was on the paper, and the defence solicitor lifted the underwear and in the trial, basically, like, she was asking for it. Look what she was wearing, the French Snickers or something like that. How that can even be allowed in the court of law is mind-blowing.
Absolutely extraordinary, but it just shows, doesn't it? You know, it's the year 2023 and that sort of still goes on. Or she was drunk, she dared to wear a short skirt, she dared to listen to music on a jog. You know.
Yeah,
and never do they talk about male violence.
I know.
And particularly in the media. And, you know, and I spent a long time researching this. And it always, there was a one that really got me, which was, it was a park in Southampton, so down near me. And it was like, honestly, this article was talking about, and it almost made it sound like the park was responsible for the rape. We're going to make our parks safer. We are taking out the bushes and we're going to put more CCTV in. And it's like, oh my God. it wasn't the park that raped the girl. Mm. It was the man. Why are we not talking about male violence? And why is no one talking about interventions and the help that these men might need?
What is the background to so many rapes? What's going on for men from the...
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. Like, and I think it's, you know, the next 10, 20 years, something's going to have to happen, right? You know, I spend a lot of time with the police in Hampshire, and they say all we're doing is going to domestic violence. That's all we're doing. Mm. You know, there is an epidemic of violence against women and girls. And then you look at the terrorism unit, which obviously has a big budget, yeah, because that's to do with if a bomb goes off in London and sort of... But actually, how often does that happen? Not very often, touch wood. Yeah. But of course they're resourced properly. So I'm not making an argument against disbanding the terrorism unit.
Of course.
But actually all the police are going, oh my God, we just don't have enough people to get to all the domestic violence that's going on, which saw something like a 200% increase during COVID when everyone was locked down.
Yeah.
And then the police will say things to me like, oh, well, you know, during the World Cup, well, it's the World Cup tonight. I'm like, yeah. And they're like, well, there's going to be more violence against women because... And I was like, oh, yeah, because people get more violent during the football. And I'm like... And I said, is it... And if England lose, it's really bad. He was like, if they win, if they lose, doesn't matter. It's alcohol and there'll be a lot of violence in the home. Just yeah, like, oh, my God.
It's just kind of accepted.
Yeah.
And COVID as well saw a big rise in domestic violence in Ireland anyway, when men were... They didn't have the employment to go to, and there was, you know, any dynamics that might have been there in regular times were very heightened during COVID when everybody was in home, and maybe the drinking at home kind of escalated as well.
Relationships were definitely tested during COVID. Everybody's relationship.
Yeah, well, I think we can all relate to that, can't we?
Everyone's, you know, because I think we really got to know our partners in life, our children. Jeez, I never spent so much time with my children, and it was great. You know, I actually enjoyed it. I got to know my children for who they were. You know, no
exactly. I think surely it was a positive experience for some people in that sense, that they got to spend more time with their kids and it was nice. Yeah. But
what's the prison system like in England? Is it true that some of the prisons are privatised and some of them are state run? How does it work?
Yeah, so there's about, I don't know exactly how many prisons there are, there's around 130 something, about 135. Only 12 of them are female prisons. And then you've got like another estate, which is part of the male estate, which is called the long-term high secure male estate. And there's like 17 in that group. And that's where the really long-term, dangerous, violent prisoners will go. And there's only 3,500 women in prison compared to around 81,000 men. Mm. Around 75% of those women are in for non-violent crimes. Mm. And the majority are in for less than 12 months. So surely that gives you a bit of a background to sort of what it looks like. I spend most of my time currently in the female estate. That's where I've worked in the male estate too and done lots of things there. But for me, you know, what I'm really interested in over my career, I've sort of done lots of different things and I've worked in Parliament and the House of Lords. I'm interested in policy and legislation. And, you know, but what I'm interested in is changing the system because the system is broken. Mm. A lot of people will say it's at breaking point. It's like, no, it's broken. It's been broken for a long time. And anybody who works in the system knows that.
What would your changes be?
Well, so what I'm working on at the minute is a project called Hope Street. Can you all remember that from Liverpool?
Yeah.
And that is about creating a community justice system that has been properly thought through about the referral routes of how women would come in, how it relates to police, probation, the magistrates, drug and alcohol services, all the other services that might be involved in a woman's recovery. Lots of people have been saying for years to the government, well, if you've got that many non-violent women in prison serving, some of them are serving weeks, some of them serve days, so long enough to lose a house if they have one, long enough to lose their job if they have one, and their certainly kids. They lose their kids. And women are usually the primary carers. So there's lots of men in prisons who are dads, but they're not, because people often say, yeah, well, men are dads too. And I'm like, no, I know that. But they're not usually the primary carer. And when they go into prison, there's usually a woman, their mother or not, or a grandmother, or to look after those children. When the mother goes, there's not usually a dad.
Yeah.
And you can probably relate to this here in Ireland as well. It's usually not a dad keeping the home together, getting them dressed for school and sort of keeping the home functioning. It just doesn't work like that.
But sometimes are the children better off taken away from the mother, do you think?
Sometimes, for sure. But we have an over-reliance on sending children into care. And, you know, what we all argue to the government, which the government has accepted, that if a woman has committed a non-violent crime, they should get a community sentence. Now, the reason that the community sentences have disappeared really as an option is because our government played around with the probation service and they tried to privatise it. Everyone said, don't do that. It's a terrible idea. It's not going to work. So they did it anyway. And it was a terrible idea and it didn't work. So now they've put it back into the public hands. And as a result, there's a recruitment crisis. Probation officers have too many people on their books. Mm. There aren't enough courses in the community for people to be able to do their community sentences. So the magistrate's like, well, I can't give them a community sentence if the courses aren't out there. So basically what we're trying to build over the County of Hampshire, which is where I'm from, is Hope Street, which is will give the magistrate a sentencing alternative to custody. So the magistrates will say, I know she's non-violent. I know she doesn't need to go to custody, but you show me the safe place that I can send her. I can't tag her into her home because there's a domestic violent partner. Yeah. Or I can't tag her into her home because she doesn't have a home. She's a sex worker. She's sleeping rough, you know, all these different. And actually the community for women presents a much more dangerous place than it does for men. Of course, the community can be dangerous for men, but in a very different way, in the sense that women are more likely to be abused by the person to whom they say, I love you. Mm. And, you know, and behind a woman's offending, and this isn't making excuses, by the way, but this is just to try and understand where it's all coming from. And I know you guys know this area well, but, you know, behind the women we see, there's a gang lord, there's a pimp, there's an abusive partner. You know, there's sort of these characters, generally speaking. When you look at a man, you don't usually have a female pimp, a female gang lord. Yes, there are, of course, female abusive partners, but it's very different. Mm. And actually, I sat on a board advising the government for about 5 years on the reforms of the female prison estate. And I think they used to think that we were saying treat women preferentially. And it was really interesting because at no point had anyone around the table ever said that, because that would be stupid. Yeah. What we were saying is you have to understand violence and you have to understand offending in a gendered way.
Yeah.
Because then you can build the right services. But you can't just take a sort of one-dimensional view of men and women in violence and expect to build services that are going to help anyone.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you think that offences related to addiction, like possession of drugs, shouldn't be criminalised in the first place, and that community supervision might just cast the carceral net even wider? And most of these people shouldn't be before a court of law anyway. They should be before maybe a committee where there's a social worker or a doctor or somebody there to kind of offer them support.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could take a much more caring approach. We know prison doesn't work.
Exactly.
There might be the odd person who goes in and it's such a horrific shock, but I'd argue they're the people who, you know, aren't on the criminal trajectory.
Yeah.
You know, it might be, I don't know, posh boy from a school looking at Google Maps and accidentally sort of hit someone in his car, or I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
There's
the different types of offending, aren't there? And the career criminals. And I think, you know, we've just got to get more sophisticated about it because prison does not work. And when you look at the age group of, I think it's young men between 20 and 22, the reoffending rate is like 87% in our country. Mm. If that was a business, it would not still be an operation
Somebody's
if it was a
sacked.
School. Yeah. But it's like, oh, gosh, this doesn't work. Let's build more prisons and do more of the same. You know, it's like really weird. Mm. So, yeah, you know, and obviously there's a big debate on should we legalise drugs and sort of pull the market, remove the market for them. I don't think any politician will ever be brave enough to do anything that radical. I think the big gap for me is also the services in the community. There needs to be more anger management courses. There needs to be more sort of help for drugs and more rehabilitation centres. And
so down through, like, people might not know about England, the UK had a heroin assisted treatment there for the last over 100 years, where the GP could actually prescribe pharmacy grade heroin to chronic heroin user. If all other treatment options failed, they were still using that, they could prescribe it. But it was through the war on drugs, you know, it was discouraged, let's say, by the UN and stuff like that. But they piloted it again there last year, and it was a huge success. Mm. But again, it's very controversial, you know.
Mm.
It's like this radical thing. It's like there's sick people, yeah, and that's the medicine. And if you give them the medicine, then it takes them out of the black market and they're not distributing, you know, bloodborne viruses. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you think about how much it costs. I don't know how much it is in England, but in Ireland, it's nearly 100 grand to keep somebody in prison for 12 months.
Mm.
It's about a quarter of a million to keep an under 18 in juvenile for 12 months.
Yeah.
You can imagine what you could do with a fraction of those resources in the community.
Yeah, I know. And then you'll spend the taxpayers spending all that money. And then they'll come out and reoffend. And it's just like, yeah, great, this is a really good way to spend our money.
I know.
And, you know, and what we're talking about in the female estate to begin with is it's nothing radical. You know, so we're building Hope Street, which will be 12 different buildings around the county. A woman will come up to the magistrate and the magistrate will now be able to say, oh, great, I don't need to send you to custody. Mm. And you've got two small children. I can send you on a community sentence to Hope Street. That can be your address. You can go with your children. You can detox there if you need to. And these are the hoops you need to jump through to, as set out by the court. Mm. Off you go. Or a woman can come on remand, if appropriate, because 60% of women who go into prison on remand get found not guilty. So they're another massive number that are choking up the prisons.
Why is this so high?
I don't know.
Probably in compared to men, like, you know, we think if they're going on remand that the girl, the police and the prosecution are, you know, they probably have some evidence on them. Why?
I don't know.
Do you know Hope Street, what do you actually do with the women when they're in there then? Say, for example, when a woman goes in there and she's drying out from heroin or alcohol or whatever it may be and the kids are there, what would you do to help them to maybe recover and to create awareness for her around the damage she may be causing with her children around her and watching it, and maybe for her to understand what's going on for her in general? Have you got counsellors or psychotherapists?
Absolutely. So first of all, if they're detoxing, then so we'll have foster carers on our staff, and we've just recruited or will recruit, I don't know where we're up to on that, the children's services manager. So there's a crash there, and the children obviously will only stay with their mothers if appropriate. You know, if it's not safe for them, the social services will make that decision anyway. It won't be down to us.
Yeah.
Each woman will be on a bespoke program. So it's not like we're just going to cookie cutter them all and sort of say, right, you'll all do this.
Yeah.
Some of them will need more anger management. Some of them might not need that. Some of them might not need very much at all. Some might have a supportive family out there. The majority, sadly, we know, don't. So absolutely, it's about a bespoke I don't want to actually use the term regime, but because it's kind of prisony, isn't it?
Yeah,
but they'll all be on their own sort of bespoke program. So they'll be doing budgeting. There'll be stuff around, you know, using.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Computers, of course, and all the things that they might not know how to do, which is what they need to be able to do just to function in everyday life.
That is a big deal, is giving people life skills.
Yeah.
And maybe having courses where you can teach them how to fill out applications and where they can get different services. Because a lot of people that are caught up in alcohol and drugs, a lot of their time is spent just thinking about where they're going to get another score,
yeah,
where they're going to get drink, you know, and they never, I suppose, when you have them in this position and they're actually, there's a bit of clarity coming to their minds and the fog is lifting, it's a great way to teach them life skills.
Mm.
And we'd done something recently, it was, I think it was Mayo, and they had a recovery college, and one of the modules on the in the college was teaching people life skills.
Yeah.
Giving them skills to live, you know, because a lot of us, I had no life skills.
Yeah.
When I stopped drinking and drugging, I didn't know nothing.
Exactly. And sort of emotional intelligence, and what do you do with your feelings, and how do you manage? Because I imagine you guys will know, I don't, but when you come off your drugs as well, I imagine all those painful feelings come to the surface that you've been blocking with those drugs, yeah, right? And so you have to be able to manage that huge rush of maybe the past coming back for the first time. And
yeah, you're right. And we're writing a book at the moment with a ghostwriter. So when you're talking to her about your life, it brings up a lot of stuff for you from your past. But she was saying, like, I would engage with the different services in the prisons, you know, and with the best of intentions. But then when I get outside the gate, it's like, Timmy talked about, I had no coping skill other than using a drug to help me calm my nerves or to relax everything.
Be stable, yeah.
And it's like, when you get out, it's like, you have to go to the social worker now, you have to queue up, you have to fill out this application form, you have to go and register as homeless to get this. It's like, no, I go to the GP and the chemist and I go to the dealer. And then as bad as it is, you're just stoned and it's just the familiar. But it's when you go to the treatment centre or aftercare as well, I had, it's like you're minded for the first few months of the process, you know? Where, like, you have a support, where you go for a bit of the day, you have a key worker when you come home, you're in a room or a house with other people like you, you know. And I think in Ireland, we've a lot of treatment options for residential treatment, but we've very little recovery options for after, when they get out.
Okay.
And that's a big problem. Like, I was lucky to get into a halfway house belonging to the Simon community here in Cork, homeless. But that was like the only house of its kind in the city.
Yeah.
And there was such a demand for it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I know you have a housing crisis here, and there's one in England too. And so the way we're going to organise it is that the main building that the women will come into first, there's 8 flats and beds for 24 women and their children. But then we'll have houses of multiple occupancy dotted around the county, because, of course, a woman might come to Southampton, but the perpetrator might live in Southampton. It might not be safe for her. Mm. She might need to relocate to another area of the county. So we'll have those houses sort of dotted around.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that will be the move on accommodation. Then our outreach workers will go and support them in their houses, as opposed to what usually happens when you're on probation. It's like, oh, right, yeah, I know you can't tell the time or read or write and you don't have a watch, but you need to get from that side of the county to this side of the county to get to your anger management course. Yes, I know you've got twins who are 2, but you need to get there on public transport with the no money that you have. And and if you don't make it to your course, and if you don't get through your course, you're going to breach your licence and you end up back in prison.
And do you know why she would end back in prison is because of the stress that creates
so hard.
Yeah. It just creates so much stress, and you just
think so actually all what is the point? Exactly. And so all we're trying to do is sort of because people go, Hope Street's revolutionary, it hasn't been done before in this depth. You know, we've been working on it for about 6 years. We'll be opening imminently. The build is about to finish. Women will come in April of this year. But it's like, no, we are setting people up to succeed. Some of them will fail, of course. But we're not setting them up to fail and then just watching them fail and throwing money at that, because that's really weird.
Mm.
And that's what we're doing at the moment. That is our system.
Yeah.
In a couple of years' time, I'll be able to say, it's all working really well.
It sounds fantastic what you're doing. And I think other countries and other governments should notice something like that and see where it goes.
Yeah, I think there's huge potential for it because it's designed to be... The methodology behind it has been designed to be replicable and scalable so that you can pick it up out of one county and do it in other counties, and it's there for the women from that county.
Is that happening for men then as well? You don't know, is the same kind of system there for men? Because in this country, if a man is in prison, right, and he is trying his best to get sober and get away from that lifestyle, a lot of the times the environment he's leaving to go into prison is the environment he's put back into.
Yeah.
And sometimes that environment is full of siblings who are involved in drugs, drug addiction, criminality, and they're going back in. In England, is there somewhere where lads who are going through this what I just said,
like a half a host, like,
a host, like,
yeah, I think I know less about the sort of men leaving prison and the data. What I would like to do, because I was talking to the builders one day and they were like, so when are you going to build Hope Street for men? And I said, well, look, I can only do one thing at a time and it's kind of a full-time job just trying to do this.
Well, you can go to set it up if you like.
Yeah, well, exactly. Come over and do that. But I said, but what I am interested in doing actually is maybe just the brain work around if I was to design Hope Street, because Hope Street has been designed to be trauma-informed and gender-specific, right? So therefore, if I was to design it for men, I would have to go through exactly the same steps. So we would collect the same data, we'd do it all the same way. And it would be really interesting to see architecturally how we would build it. Because, you know, would we have a crash? I'm not sure. Would we actually have a workshop for men to do, you know, which we don't for the women? And and Hope Street was designed in consultation with justice-involved women. So we would do the same and we would have men feeding into the architectural design because that's the only right way to build things for people. But I did say to the builders, one of the biggest things we've had to do with Hope Street, because we'll have a coffee shop that's open to the public. So it's a semi-open building. And it's not that it's anything like a prison, because these women should be in their own homes on a tag. Yeah. So they're able to leave, come and go, and some of them will have been released from prison. But what we have to be really, really careful of is men turning up, trying to access the women and the children.
Yeah.
And it's not like the prisons call us and go, oh, by the way, this really violent guy who's, you know, the boyfriend of one of your women, you know, it's not like you get the heads up. They just turn up outside the building, and that's our biggest fear, and it is going to happen, so we just have to be ready for it. So
you
we have
a prison officer there, or someone that resembles
certainly not officers, no, because that for someone the women would not work. Of course.
Okay.
And we've designed it so that we've got good lines of sight onto the pavement, and actually the site that we bought, that we knocked down and built on, was really important, because you don't want it out in a field in the middle of this countryside, because that's terrifying, and then the sort of women are quite vulnerable. So you want it in a busy place where there's sort of lots of things going on and there's always cars going past. So I was saying to the builders, do you think if we had Hope Street for men, we'd be worried about the women turning up trying to access the men? And they all laughed and they were like, we wish. But it's a really interesting point, isn't it? Yeah. When you flip it on its head. And we got planning permission through the first time for Hope Street, which we were shocked about, actually. And I wonder if it was 24 men, would we get planning permission through?
That's great. Remember
probably not.
The Simon, I think there was a halfway house supposed to go somewhere in the city over by McCurtain Street, and because it was going to attract people from the homeless people,
they were going to use that for the women coming from Limerick Prison. It's on Patrick's Hill.
It was cancelled.
It was cancelled, yeah.
Residents in the area put in a petition.
They were afraid. Cancelled.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, so therefore, in the design, so we were designing Hope Street for like 5-6 years before we started looking to buy a plot and architecturally design. We were designing the methodology. And you'd have to do the same. So therefore, if you're like, I don't think we'd get planning, then you have to be more creative, don't you?
Yeah.
Be like, right, so how do we work things out for men? How will we make it work?
Do you know what it reminds me of? There's an organisation in Ireland called Cool Mine, and it's a drug and alcohol treatment. It's an addiction centre, but they have two facilities specifically for women and children. And one of them is in West Dublin, but it's in a suburb, but it's kind of away from the housing estates, and it's surrounded by trees, so you can't see it from the road, you know, and it's secure. But in there then, it's, they have like the women and the children, the babies, they're all together, and they're all healing together, and it's a beautiful community. But they recently opened another one in Limerick there last year as well. But
What's it called?
Cool Mine. If you're interested, I can make contact with the CEO, because I used to work there.
I love the name as well.
It sounds
very like what you're talking about.
Yeah.
What you're building.
Exactly. Sort of healing environments and a bit like, you know,
community.
Limerick Prison, which, you know, I'll be seeing tomorrow. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got to be careful with language, because some people are like, that's disgraceful. These people, they've committed crimes. Yeah. And, you know, and I always kind of say to people, yeah, I get that. But I think we're all agreed that we want people to come out either less dangerous, don't we? And they go, yeah. And it's like, right, well, I know it's really unpalatable, but if you do want someone to come out less violent, we do actually know what we need to do in order to make that happen.
Yeah.
So we need to do it.
We started this conversation today talking about you could be born into any life. You could be born into a life where it's complete poverty or there's a lot of wealth. But people tend to forget that people are born into lives where they have no control over it. Like, I didn't have a control over the life. James didn't. Like, people in Limerick prison, Cork prison, we have no control over it. And some of the situations that we're born into, they mold us as human beings, you know. Some of us cut off at a really young age because of stuff that happens to us, and we just cut the line. So we go on then, we've no trust in society, we've no trust in people, you know, we've no understanding of life should be, or how to work, or how to process emotions and feelings. And one of the main areas of what we do this is to change people's perception of people who are in prison. No, people do bad things and they deserve to go to prison, you know. Not everybody, because some people are just sick, may have psychological problems and etc. But what we try to do is just give people a little bit more in their minds and just to understand. And the whole emphasis of what we do is sharing people's stories. So when people hear the background of someone's story and why they became addicted to drugs, on the streets, in prison, people start opening up a small bit. And this education, I think, is educating people around these issues and why people turn out in different ways.
Yeah.
It's all about the look of the draw.
Absolutely. And I do think more could be done at schools. I know there's a lot to cram into the national curriculum, but I think justice is such a big topic. I do a lot of work in the Crown Courts and, you know, they're extraordinary environments. But, you know, we've got all these kids growing up who have absolutely no idea of the consequences of their actions. You know, we've got a law in England called joint enterprise, which is like, right, well, you might have the knife and you might kill someone, but you're standing next to him, so you're going to go to prison for life too, because he's murdered someone. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you tell kids that, like, what? You know, and it's really important. If you commit a crime, you get a criminal record. You're never going to America. You know, it's like some pretty big things that people need to.
Even if two adolescents have consensual sex, you can be charged with a sex crime if they're underage, you know, if the parents want to take case. But some of the young people and their families, they don't know that.
No.
But you're a sex offender, and that's never leaving your record.
Yeah.
You know, and I think what you were saying there as well was important, is around a critical education. I remember when I went into prison for the first time when I was 18, and I see, like, there was six landings, and A wing, three on A and three on B, and A3 was all fellas from my estate, you know, about like 1 kilometre radius, about 30, and then on B3 was like all travellers, not different traveller clans and families. Then there was a lot of Polish, Nigerians, Romanians. There was people then from council estates and Waterford and Kerry, and you just kind of accept it. But it's only when I got older and I started studying social science and criminology and stuff like that, I began to look at that and think, no, they're not all bad people, not all travellers are criminals, not all people from my housing estate are born into. There's loads of structural forces at play as well, and it's not about looking for excuses, but it's just to get people understanding. Exactly.
And the sort of trouble that we're actually creating by our systems.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm so interested in system change, because sick systems create sick people. And, yeah. You
went down about education, and I know Georgie's probably going to love this, but I think a massive part of it with the education is as well is a lot of the children that are in school aren't getting the education to meet their needs and their ability. And what happens then is, and it happened to me, because I wasn't understood in school, they didn't understand what was going on for me, why I was so disruptive, why I didn't understand what this teacher was saying. I was classified as a child then that was bold. and kept at the back. But if we start implementing all these assessments at a young age and start understanding the kids that are in the school, instead of teaching them the norm like we teach like the education system is, what we can do is start filling in the cracks in the system where all these children with learning differences and other needs are slipping through. And what that stops then as well, and this is my understanding of it, is if a child spends more time in school because they're enjoying it, they won't go on the hop. And if they're on the hop from school, which is on the mitch from school, they're causing antisocial behaviour, they're robbing, they're using drugs. We're going to stop drug addiction down the line. We'll stop homelessness down the line, prison sentences. Mm-hmm. We have to educate children. You know, they have to get an education. They have to understand how life works, how their emotional system works, how to process emotions. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't learn these things at a young age, what happens? We will use alcohol and drugs to soothe ourselves as we get older, because the doctor's not going to give them to him because he thinks he'll go to prison if he does, you know. So that's my understanding of it. That's one way we can definitely help it as well.
I completely agree. And my organisation is one called One Small Thing. And actually, a lot of the work that we do is about putting therapeutic interventions into prisons, male prisons and female prisoners. But it's all about them addressing the trauma that they've suffered. Mm. And we train the prisoners up themselves to be able to lead the groups because it works better. And then they all start going because they're like, oh, great. Well, if it's not an officer leading the group, then I'll definitely go if it's one of the other people off the wing. And and just that thing of, well, you're really angry because you were sexually abused as a child. Well, you're completely right to feel angry. Yeah. And actually that's a legitimate, healthy response. Mm. But actually you need to make sure it's not harming you and other people. Yeah, yeah. So guess what? The really exciting thing is there's things you can do to help yourself that don't cost anything.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and of course some people need big psychological interventions, but quite frankly, who has the money to access them? Not very many people. Mm. And certainly not people in prison. So so I think, you know, I'm the forever optimist. You know, there is a huge amount of stuff that we can be doing, and I think our prisons should be trauma informed, trauma responsive, trauma specific, you name it, you know, because they're traumatized systems, they're traumatizing places to work in, you know, let alone to serve a sentence in.
Talk to us about the clink.
That one,
so that's another organization you set up.
So I was one of the founding investors. So I can't lay credit to the idea. So there was a prison officer. He was the chef in the prison at the time. And he sort of was like, he is half like Italian and then half East End lad in London, really a real character. And he was like, there's no reason why we couldn't have a fine dining restaurant inside a prison, open to the public. And we were like, that's absolutely ridiculous, but I love it. And he was like, no, you know, these men have got so much potential and it's such a therapeutic thing to be doing, working with the food. And like, yeah. And so I was asked to put some money in. And I said, well, if you find other people to put the money in, I'll put a part of the money in, but come back to me when you've got everyone else, thinking he won't get anyone else. And he did. He came back and he said, I've got all the money. So I was like, okay, fine. And then I got quite involved in it, and sort of recruited the first chief executive in, who sort of then did 11 years and rolled it out from one clink to two clinks to three to four, I think we got to. So fundamentally, for those people listening who don't know, we started building fine dining restaurants inside prisons. So the prisoners were trained up to be able to cook the food, to serve the food. The environment was kind of like glass tables, ambient lighting, nice pictures on the wall, not like a greasy spoon cafe, this is fine dining. The food, they made the pasta from scratch, they made the sauces from scratch, the fish would come in whole, and the fish would, if you wanted a coffee, it was like, would you like a macchiato with oat milk? You know, it was proper. So that by the time the men had gone through and got their GMVQs in sort of all the different things they needed, they were able to leave to get a good job, not just flipping burgers and McDonald's. Yeah. They really were able to go to the smart restaurants in London and get a good job. But the other amazing thing that we hadn't really thought about, we were like, yes, it'd be nice if it's open to the public, but the paying public could literally come into these restaurants. So Brixton Prison, Highdown Prison in Surrey, Cardiff Prison in Wales, and then we had one in a women's prison in Manchester in Stile. And so what that did was allow a sort of a whole swathe of general public to be able to come in and learn about prisoners. And the preconceived ideas.
Was this a section onto the prison or built onto it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the one in Brixton Prison, inside the walls, it was the old governor's house. So just through the main gate where the vans would go in and out. So a building inside. Stile on the prison property, but sort of outside the main walls. Mm. And Cardiff Prison just outside the walls. And then Downview was inside the walls. High Down, sorry, inside the walls. So you had to go through the exercise yard to get through the door into the restaurant. Mm. So you go from this like horrendous prison environment, then walk through the door and there'd be like classical music playing and you're just like, and the men would be walking around in their uniforms looking really smart. And it was incredible. So we'd often get, you know, busloads of old people coming in and sort of, you know, they'd get really excited and they'd come in. And people might have preconceived ideas and be slightly like, well, do the crime, do the time type of thing. But then they'd see the men nervous, right, and really wanting to do their best and to be able to get that pea soup onto the table without sort of slopping it around and being really upset if they'd marked the bowl, you know, because they were trying to do it right. And I think it really was an incredible space to sort of bring down those barriers and to get people really thinking about, do you really hate this person?
Yeah,
maybe they've done a bad thing, but they're not a bad person.
Yeah.
So they're incredible places. And so Brixton became one of the best on TripAdvisor. It was in the top five restaurants in London ages. I know. And I'm not a foodie at all. And I, you know, I never thought I'd end up in the restaurant trade, but prisons has taken me in weird places. But, you know, people wanted to go and you can go in for breakfast, you can go in for lunch. You can go in for dinners on certain evenings when the regime allows.
Is the that's what I was just going to say. Is it all down to the timelines for serving, for food? Is it down to, say, you get up maybe 8, there's a close then at 7 for lockdown?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's quite good. So if you ever wanted to do a dinner, so I'd often invite like policy makers or journalists in to have like those sort of impact dinners because they were a great place to do it and no one had their mobile phones, right? So you'd get everyone's attention. And then it would be like, right, you're going to have to eat up because literally the men are leaving at 7 o'clock. So in a way, people liked it because they knew it wasn't a dinner where you'd be sat around for hours getting really bored. It's like, no, you know, it's time for lock up.
There was no lock-ins anywhere.
There were no lock-ins.
Lock-ins for a few,
No, exactly.
What else are you doing?
So I have my podcast, which is called Justice. So there's Hope Street, there's the podcast Justice. And a bit like you is, you know, listening to all the chat about criminal justice, whether it's through the papers or on the news reports. And it's like, that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of these issues. Mm-hmm. You need a deeper knowledge of justice. Actually, it's really important to all of us. So I'll interview people like the chief inspector of prisons. I interviewed a guy who'd done double life sentence for a double murder. He was talking about forgiveness. I've interviewed victims of rape. You know, it's sort of a bit like you guys. It's sort of whoever is related to justice. And things like the parole board. You know, what the hell does the parole board do? Why should we care? Probation system. A lot of people, I don't think, even understands what the probation system is. And it's really important people know. So, and I just enjoy that. I don't, my husband's always like, how many listeners have you got? And I'm like, I have no idea. I'm a female. I don't care. I just really enjoy it.
A lot of the topics you spoke about there, we've covered or had very similar people like that and in this jurisdiction.
Yeah, exactly. And then, as I said, you know, so we've got, under the banner of One Small Thing, we have all these trauma trainers. So we go into the prisons and train the prison staff, but we also do third sector organisations. We've trained like England Boxing to be trauma informed. They were running workshops in a prison. They were like, God, we're really aware that boxing's quite violent. We're working with men who've had violence. How can we do this in a more sensitive way? So that was incredible. Production companies who are wanting to interview people who've suffered trauma, and they're like, actually, how can we get the best out of the people we're interviewing, so we'll train them. And that's been really...
Yeah, that's great.
That's been, you know, there's a huge... Because it's not about prisons, is it? It's about people. Yeah. And it's about the fact that we all go through shit and suffer shit.
Yeah.
Excuse my French, but it's true.
Yeah.
And we all need to know how to deal with that and process it. And you can't just go around hitting people and stabbing people.
Yeah.
Mm. you know, we need to know, we need to understand our emotions and be able to.
And you can't lock somebody up and hope they'll never again commit a crime. And what we do is not soft on crime, it's intelligent on crime, because a lot of the time prison is not a deterrent for people. It's just something that they'll endure until they get out. But you have to provide meaningful employment and meaningful opportunities so that we have less victims down the line. And that's kind of why we do what we do, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. One funny thing that I am doing that is actually like my second job that will make you laugh because it's weird and British. So I'm the High Sheriff of Hampshire. Yeah, see? I knew that I'd get a giggle. So you'll be like...
Not just the sheriff, the High Sheriff.
The High Sheriff. So, I thought I'd mention it because it is hilarious. So basically, it's the oldest office bar the monarchy in our country. So it's been around for thousands of years. And So you become the High Sheriff. You only hold office for 1 year. You have to be sort of chosen by the Queen, now the King. And you are the King's representative in the county for law and order. You have to wear an incredible outfit, which is like velvet and with ruffly sleeves and like a weird ruffly neck thing and a hat with an ostrich feather on it. And it has to be an ostrich feather. Yeah. Someone said to me once, and it was really funny because they were completely accurate. They said, "You look like the love child of Dick Whittington and Austin Powers."
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And honestly, I was like, you are absolutely right. I can't argue with that. So I don't always have to wear that outfit. But when the ceremonial things in the High Court and all the judges are in their regalia, then I would have to be in my regalia. So I spend a lot of time as a result with the police. But it's access all areas justice system for 1 year. So obviously for me, I was like, that's amazing. Just an extension of what I do anyway. Yeah. So I am able to say to the police, right, can I come out with you tonight and do the nighttime economy with you? They're like, yeah, sure, turn up at the station at 9. We'll come back in at 5 in the morning. Can I go to a crime scene? Yeah, of course you can. Can I come on a drugs raid? Yes, of course you can. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So it's really given me such an insight into...
Did you ever write a book?
Huh?
Would you ever write a book? Both
well, I'm also dyslexic, so that fills me sort of with absolute horror.
Okay, you need a ghostwriter. Like
yeah, exactly, yeah. A non-dyslexic. A non-dyslexic ghostwriter.
But it'd be great to get your stories in text for people, especially people in prisons and stuff that they could read. And, you know, maybe speaking about the different experiences in prisons in different countries and different jurisdictions. And all the stuff you're doing, that's all very interesting stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
And important.
Yeah. Yeah, well, very, very luckily, important. I just love it. And I just think I've got, you know, so I was like, oh, I'm going to come and see my friend Georgie over there in Cork. That'll be nice. And then I was like, actually, if I'm going to Ireland, I could probably get myself into a couple of prisons. So, you know, when I went on holiday to Sri Lanka, and as we came into the hotel with my kids and my husband, he went, "Have you seen what's across the road?" And I was like, "Of course I've seen what's across the road." And it was the local prison. And even I was like, it's a bit of a busman's holiday. And Dan was, my husband was like, "No, Dweeney, you've got to go." I was like, "Really? Do you really want?" I was like, "All right." So we were talking to my guide and I was like, "You don't happen to know anyone who works in the prison, do you?" He was like, "Yeah, my brother's the doctor." So I was like, "Oh, could I maybe pop in and have a visit?" He was like, "Yeah, sure." So the next morning I left the kids eating their croissants with my husband and off I went and spent a bit of time in the prison. But I think it just adds such excitement to travel as well. You know, my husband's a historian. He needs a battlefield. I need a prison.
Yeah.
So if you ever meet us at a bar on holiday, we're like the weird couple talking about battles and prisons and violence. And
well, I hope you enjoy our prisons while you're over here.
Yeah, me too. I'm visiting Limerick and Cork. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
We're actually doing something ourselves. And is it March? It's Mental Health Week within the prison system. So we're going to every prison in the country.
Oh, wow. How many is that?
14.
Okay.
Because some of the prisons have women and men.
Yeah.
And some of the prisons have protection landings and main prisons. And there's some open prisons. Mm-hmm. So we're going to visit everybody over the course of 7 days, doing mental health workshops and assistance workshops and stuff like that.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's a big commitment for us because it's a lot of travel around the country, but it's going to be an amazing experience.
Yeah.
And we're really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and it's very important as well that by myself and James sharing our experience with the lads and giving them some different pathways to the life that we have today, it gives them hope.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's very important. And
you know, you're going to have to gear yourself up for when all these men start coming out and they're going to, they are going to be calling you, aren't they? And
yeah.
again, it's a big responsibility, isn't it? And
it is.
Trying to help all those people that you've inspired. And I sometimes feel the same a bit. It's like, ah.
Do you know what the downside of it is? We not having the time. Not having the time. Yeah. And the, what's the right word?
The resources.
The resources.
We're talking there now about setting up our own foundation. So, like, we get asked to do a lot of talks in schools and youth clubs and probation fund projects and all that. But we work full time. So, but we set up, long story short, and I won't bore people, but we set up as a private limited company when revenue started coming in here, donations and stuff, just for tax purposes. But it means we're excluded for grants from the government, you know? But with a non-profit status, I think that we can start bringing in grants and then do it full time. So that's our goal for 2023.
Well, good luck with it all.
Thank you. And listen, it's been lovely speaking with you.
Thanks
for coming on.
Thank you for having me along.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And enjoy Limerick Prison tomorrow.
I will. Thank you.
God bless. See you later.
Thanks, lads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.